hear you're an uncle. I hear you're an uncle.
What's that?
You had a niece last week?
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
See you. Enjoy. Okay, so I don't know how many of you had a chance to read the Mystery Project. How many of you had a chance to read the Mystery Project? Okay, that's a good start. How many of you had a chance to look at the data? Okay, that's the next start. Because this is a pricing project, and I want to emphasize the word pricing, and I'm not going to say much more about that, because for the rest of today, I'm going to talk about pricing as opposed to valuation. Okay? The reason I say that is I've had a few emails about the project that suggest to me that you might not be getting what it means to price something. You're still caught up in the, and I blame myself because we've been immersed in the value part, right, for almost 10 weeks. We've been talking about cash flows and growth and risk and tying them all together. This is really about pricing. So let's get this pricing game on the road by starting with some very simple startup tests from last week's session, actually, on pricing, right? So here's the first one. We talked about PEG ratios. If you remember the PEG ratio, what do? I take the price-earnings ratio, I divide by the growth rate, I come up with a number. So if your price-earnings ratio is 20 and your growth rate is 10%, I divide 20 by 10, I come up with 2. And I do this for every company. And then I compare the PEG ratios across companies. That's an inherent part of pricing. You almost always have to be doing comparisons across companies. So here's my question for you, and it kind of goes into the implicit assumptions that often drive multiples. When I use the PEG ratio, I am assuming that as growth doubles, PE doubles. Growth triples, PE doubles. I'm assuming a linear relationship between PE and growth, which turns out not to be true. It's an assumption. It's not a good assumption. So my question is really about the bias you create when you pick stocks based on PEG ratio. So I'm going to ask you to tell me which direction the bias is going to go. Is it going to bias me? So if I'm picking stocks based on the lowest PEG ratios, will it lead me to be biased against low-growth stocks, high-growth stocks, or do you don't think there's going to be a bias based on growth? Fernando?
High growth.
Tell me why.
Because growth
as growth increases, if you look at price, price actually starts level off. You draw a graph of value against it. So just take a discounted cash flow model. Increase it, try it with your own company, right? Change the growth rate. Graph out the value. As growth increases, value will start increasing at a lesser and lesser rate. So if I'm not careful, if I pick stocks based on PEG ratios, I'm going to find a lot of high growth stocks are cheap to me, right? And low growth, actually it's biased against low growth stocks, it's biased towards high growth stocks. Right? Let's talk about EV to EBITDA multiples. We talked about how cross-holdings kind of kick into EV to EBITDA multiples. Here again, I want to focus in on specifically the issue of cross-holdings. If you remember, in the numerator, your market value of equity plus debt minus cash, that's the enterprise value, divided by the EBITDA. Let's suppose you have a company with a lot of cross holdings, small holdings in other companies. And I put that into the pile and I compute EV to EBITDA. Will this company look cheap or expensive on an EV to EBITDA basis if it has a lot of cross holdings? What happens if you have a lot of cross holdings? Your market value will reflect the cross holdings, right? So your market value is going to be higher. So you take a Tata Motors, it's going to be a lot of holdings. But in the denominator, I have EBITDA. You're saying, so what? When you have cross holdings, remember the income from the EBITDA is not, the income from the cross holdings is not part of your EBITDA. So if you're not careful, it's going to look very expensive to you when in fact it's nothing of the sort. Again, very, very easy for bias to creep in if you're not watching out for it. One final example. Let's say you want to find a cheap stock based on EV to EBITDA basis. So it's a sign that a company is cheap, but for low EV to EBITDA to translate into cheap, which of the following conditions have to hold? The first, company doesn't have huge upcoming capital expenditure needs. Second, company has a high return on capital. Third, company does not have a high cost of capital. Fourth, the company does not face a high tax rate. Which of the four have to hold? What is the combination you want for the EV to EBITDA? You want low EV to EBITDA? You want low tax rate or high tax rate? You want low tax rate. You want high return on capital. You want a low cost of capital. In other words, you look at that. All the conditions have to hold. Otherwise, the stock might actually just be trading at low EV to EBITDA because it trades at low EV to EBITDA. When you talk about pricing, that's what I want you to think about. I know we have all those intrinsic value equations all over the pricing section. So when I did PE, I did the dividend discount model and did the algebra and I did price to book. Why did we do that? Why did I do that? It's not fair to ask why did we do that, because obviously I did it. Why did I give you those intrinsic value models? Is it because I wanted to plug numbers back into the model to tell me what the P/E ratio for a stock should be or price to book? Because if that was the intent, there's no point even doing this section, because then I'm just using a dividend discount model or a firm valuation model to come up with the value for a company. The reason I did that is to find out what variables drive each multiple. So at the end of the PE, when I did that dividend discount model, I said PE is driven by three variables, payout, cost of equity, and growth. And then I abandoned that equation. And when I looked at comparing companies across a sector, I looked at controlling for those variables. So separate what those equations tell you about multiples from what you have to do in pricing. So I'm going to start today with something that's actually pretty close to what you're doing on your project. So it might be a good time for you to kind of, if you don't quite get what you're doing, to kind of jump in and ask me some questions. So here's what I do every year. In fact, I repeat this every 6 months. I pulled up the price-to-book ratios of the 100 largest market cap stocks in the U.S. So just like your sample of 200 large, yours is 200 largest market cap stocks globally, I picked the 100 largest market cap stocks in the U.S. This was in January 2010. I computed the price-to-book ratios for every stock. Basically, I took the market cap. When I say computed, I'm not plugging things into equations. I'm just taking the market capitalization dividing by book equity. I did that for every company. So I had the price-to-book for every company. Remember we talked about companion variables, a key number that drives every multiple? With price to book, what's that companion variable going to be? Try the little trick I asked you to. Remember the trick was if you have an equity multiple, what should you do? Take net income and divide by the denominator of your multiple. Net income divided by book equity is? What do I get? It's return equity. So here's what I did. I computed the return equity for every company. No rocket science. I haven't done any calculations, intrinsic valuation. So the price to book for every, so think of this as an Excel spreadsheet. I have 100 companies. I have the price to book in the first column, the return equity in the next column. I could have done all kinds of statistics, but I wanted to first visualize the data, see what it looked like on a scatter plot. You know what a scatter plot is? The price to book on one axis, return equity in the other, you put them all. So this is the scatter plot for all 100 largest market cap companies. So I get this, each point is there for a stock. What do you think those three lines are that I've drawn through those points? What's the middle line, you think? I ran a regression. When you run a regression, you fit a line through your scatter plot. So that was my regression line. The outer lines are actually the 90th. You know how when you draw a regression, you have confidence intervals? So if you have a good statistics package, it'll actually draw those. You think, what's the point? any point that falls between those two lines, I cannot reject the hypothesis that it's actually fairly valued. So see all those points in the middle? They're off the regression line, but they're actually within the bounds, so statistically they're all fairly valued. So where are my interesting stocks? My interesting stocks are the stocks that fall above the line and those that fall below the line. So help me out here. When I'm looking for overvalued stocks in this graph, where would I find them? Above the line or below the line? It's got to be above the line because they have high price to book. So there are three stocks that show up as overvalued when I run this. One is, let's see if you know the symbols. One is Google. The second is Infosys, which is an Indian company. The third is Gilead Systems, which is a pharmaceutical company. At least in January 2010, if I look at price to book and return equity, they look overvalued when I look at controlling for return on equity. The three stocks that fall below the line are, let's see if you recognize symbols. What's XOM? It's ExxonMobil. The second is NOK is Nokia. And COP is ConocoPhillips. And already red flags should start going off. Why? Because two of the three stocks that look cheap to me are oil stocks. And the reason that should trigger a red flag is maybe they're cheap or maybe there's something that happened in the sector that's making them look cheap. You're saying, what are you talking about? How do I compute the return equity? I took last year's net income and divided by book equity, right? So if oil prices dropped in the last 6 months, what's going to happen? The price is going to reflect it, but the return equity is going to look high. That's something I want you to think about. When you find five cheap stocks out of the 200, and four of them are Chinese steel companies, I would be very, very careful about jumping to the conclusion that these are cheap stocks, because you want the five stocks to be as different as they can be, because that means you're finding something truly unusual rather than a sector-driven factor. So Google, Infosys, and Gilead Systems look expensive. Conoco, Nokia, and ExxonMobil look cheap. I don't think Conoco and ExxonMobil are cheap. I think that's an oil sector effect. Nokia was on the verge of toppling over. So my bottom line is none of those stocks look exciting enough that I'm going to go out and buy the stocks. But let's focus on the three stocks that look overvalued here. Google, Infosys in 2010, and Gilead. What do you think they shared in common that might explain why they look overvalued when in fact they might not be? One is risk, but that's a bad thing. You want something good to explain the high price to book. What are the three things we control for? We control for return equity, we control for risk, and we control for growth, right? And in this case, the high growth stocks are the ones that look expensive, but we're not controlling for growth. I have only two axes, right? Price to book, return equity. Can I do a three-dimensional graph? In fact, in Excel, you can do a three-dimensional graph. It's crazy as hell to even read because it looks like this. It looks like a cardboard box. It's three-dimensional. So I want you to help me. So think of this as a wooden box in front of you. In one corner are your cheap stocks. I'd like you to tell me which corner of this box I'm looking for my cheap stocks in. So let me go axis by axis. Do I want a low price to book or a high price to book? I want a low price to book. I want a high return equity or a low return equity? I want a high return equity. So basically, I'm coming towards this corner. Do I want high growth or low growth? So basically, I want stocks that end up right. I can't even. There's no picture here. But in that bottom corner of the box. What the hell is going on here? I can't see it. But see where the TWX is? Oh, right there. Right below it. So that's where I'm looking. And guess what? There's nothing there. Should I be surprised? What are these? 100 largest market cap stocks in the world, right? I'd be amazed if one actually was so severely mispriced that it just sat there like a sitting duck saying, that. But if I took 100 mid-cap stocks or 100 Latin American stocks, stocks that are less followed, who knows what you can find? As I said, no harm looking. That's why we do pricing. So already you can see that because I picked your 200 largest market cap stocks, you're not going to find any that are so hopelessly mispriced that they just jump out at you. So your layers are going to be much more subtle simply because of the selection bias of the companies you're looking at. So price book. I can't draw a four-dimensional graph. It's beyond me. But the other thing, as Anna pointed out, is risk, right? Which, you know, maybe there are riskier stocks, and ConocoPhillips and Nokia and ExxonMobil look cheap, or they could just be risky. So you could even do a different kind of three-dimensional graph where you have price to book return equity and beta. And here your cheapest stocks are in this corner of the box. You can't see the picture, but right below ExxonMobil, that corner. Because you want low beta, you want high return equity, and low price to book. So it's kind of fun just drawing these graphs as if you have variable or multiple you're trying to control for, just to see what it looks like on a picture is often much more instructive than running a multiple regression, though I think multiple regressions still have a role to play. Now, obviously, with graphs like this, you're stuck with, at the most, two variables, right? Growth and return equity, risk and return equity. If you want to bring in more than two variables, you have to open up your regression toolbox. So this is the same sample of 100 largest market cap stocks. I'm still looking at price to book as my dependent variable. I'm looking at three independent variables, the beta, the growth rate, and the return equity. Now do you see why I did that intrinsic value analysis before I did this? Because I know what I need to, because otherwise I'm sitting there trying, what should I regress against? I could throw this, I could throw that. This is not a kitchen sink regression. You know what a kitchen sink regression is? We've all been guilty of this in statistics classes. A kitchen sink regression is a regression where you have a singular mission, which is get the highest R squared you can. So you try this, it didn't work, try this. Weight of the CEO, fat CEO seemed to pull up my R squared, throw it in there. You're saying that doesn't make sense. It doesn't have to because it's a kitchen sink regression. Here I've stopped with only those variables that should drive price to book, and I'm saying that's it. Return equity, beta, and growth, and I have a regression, which I can use to do what? Get the predicted price to books for each of my 100 companies and then tell you which stocks are the five cheapest. So if my mission with these 100 companies were to find the five cheapest, five most expensive, I would take this regression, plug in the numbers for each company, get a predicted price to book for each company, and then compare the actual price to book to that predicted price to book. I would have my cheapest stocks, my most expensive stocks, and it would be a pricing. It would not be a valuation. Because I'm not doing intrinsic value of each company. I'm just looking at how they're priced relative to each other. Any questions? So I updated this for January 2017. So basically the same thing I did in 2010. Let's see what looks cheap and what looks expensive again. So I fit them all in. Okay? There's my regression line. Seeing what does that mean? How would I read that regression? 1.41 plus 0.19 times return, X is your return equity, Y is your price to book. Every 1% increase in my return equity increases my price to book by 0.19. So basically, if I have a much higher return equity as a company, I'd expect to trade at a very high price to book. Like whom? What's MO? Does anybody know what the MO is the symbol for? It's Philip Morris. Okay? Philip Morris has one of the highest price to book ratios. But the 100, it also has a very high return equity. So it's got a very high price to book. Why do you think it has such a high return equity and very high price to book ratio? Doesn't it? People are not smoking more cigarettes. There's not much growth. For the last 10 years, Philip Morris has been buying back stock because it has so much cash. So what happens when you buy back stock? Your book equity shrinks. Your price to book ratio goes through the roof. Your return equity goes up, you're seeing the consequence of 10 years of buyback. So Philip Morris has a really high price to book, but it's not overpriced because given its return equity, that's what you'd expect. So let's look for the mismatches. What's BA? See, that looks like Bank of America. Bank of America is BAC. BA is Boeing. There's UPS, Clorox, Netflix. I'm going to let you take those four stocks and take a closer look at them. They could be overvalued or there must be something we're missing, right? With Netflix, the answer seems easy. What might we be missing when we just look at price to book and return equity? That explains a high price to book growth, right? So that's what I want to do with each one of these variables. I want to focus on what could we be missing. And if the answer is nothing, I know you've already picked a company to do your DCF on. You've already completed it. But you want another company to try it? This might be an interesting company. Maybe there's something that explains why the stock is so overvalued. Okay? Below the line, You have G-I-L-D. Does it look familiar? Let me go back. Gilead Systems has gone from being an extremely overvalued stock in 2010 to the most undervalued stock, at least on a price-to-book basis. How the mighty have fallen. You look at price-to-book for Gilead, it was way above, what, 4, 5, 6, and it looked overvalued. The return, the price-to-book has tumbled, the return equity has tumbled, it's now looks cheap. In fact, the only other stock that falls below the line is VZ, which is Verizon, right? So I know somebody in this class is doing Verizon. Again, when we talk about pricing stocks, this is the way you price stocks. It's basically by comparing the stock to how other stocks like it are being priced in the market. So that's 100 largest market cap stocks, very similar to what you have as a mystery project. You can see how you use multiples to make judgments about what's cheap and expensive rather than doing the discounted cash flow valuation. You think, what do I gain by doing it? If you actually wanted to do discounted cash flow valuations on the mystery project, what would you need to do? 200 discounted cash flow valuations. That's a lot of DCFs to do. Now you see why portfolio managers who have to track 1,000 stocks, 2,000 stocks, 3,000 stocks can't even afford to do it. They just don't have enough people to grind out the discounted cash flow valuation. This is a shortcut that lets you decide where to put your money. Any questions? So I'm going to take you back in time again. Remember the roles I was playing as an equity research analyst? I'm now going to become the trucking analyst. I have a really boring life. I follow trucking companies. Nothing exciting about this sector, but I put out a buy recommendation. You've got to do something to make your life exciting. And the buy recommendation I put on a company called Ryder Systems. You heard of Ryder? It rents out trucks. It's a big trucking company. Why do I like Ryder Systems? I'm a very simplistic analyst. I like Ryder Systems because it trades at 2.81 times EBITDA. Don't even try to read those numbers. They can blind you. 2.81 times EBITDA, which is half the enterprise value to EBITDA multiple of the sector. The sector trades at 5.6 times EBITDA. I say, buy Ryder Systems. It's cheap. It's trading at 2.8 times EBITDA. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to act like the recipient of my equity research report, and I want you to ask me the questions that will make sure before you buy the stock that Ryder Systems is cheap. Okay, get started. What's the first question you're going to ask me? What are the variables that drive EV to EBITDA? Go down the list. Fernando? What's the growth? They're all boring, low-growth companies. So let's take that off the list. It's not as if this is a negative growth company and everybody else is positive growth. They're all low-growth companies. Luis? Is it risky? Basically, I can show you the cost of capital. Maybe it is a huge amount of debt like Valiant on the verge of disaster. You look at the debt ratio, it looks very much like the rest of the sector. Its cost of capital is very close to the cost of capital sector. So check that out. It's starting to look interesting. So basically, it's not risk. Return on capital. That's because remember, when you have a really low return on capital, you can have a low EV to EBITDA. These companies all have returns on capital barely above their cost of capital. Ryder Systems doesn't look too bad on that basis either. So its growth looks okay, its risk looks okay, its return on... What about, should you ask anything questions about tax rates? What's with the EV to EBITDA, why do tax rates matter? Because you're looking at a pre... Maybe Ryder Systems has an 85% tax rate, right? So what's the tax rate? Let's get that out of the way. Its tax rate, its effective tax rate is very close to the rest of the sector. But there's one quirk about trucking companies that I have to throw into the mix, and maybe this will frame your next question. Trucking companies don't do CapEx like most of the companies, where they do CapEx every year. What they do actually is replace their entire fleet once every X years. Why? Because it gives them a bigger discount. They can go to Ford or GM and say, we're going to replace our entire fleet because we're doing the whole fleet. Get us. So they don't have CapEx every year, but they do have to replace it. So what's the last question you should ask me?
Are they not capitalizing their leases?
Well, they're not even leasing. They're actually buying the trucks. So that's a good question. They'd be capitalizing the leases, but they're buying the trucks. What did it say? They replace their trucks every X years. What's the question? How old is this fleet, right? And here's where the catch came. Ryder Systems had the oldest fleet in this sector. Now do you see how you can be, if you're not careful, how you can, I pulled this right out of an actual equity research report. So buy recommendation on Ryder. Why? Because it's trading at 2.8 times EBITDA. All I had to do was go into each trucking company's 10K, and they reported the life of their, and you list it up in the last column, and there you have it, Ryder System. You're saying, so what? You're going to buy Ryder Systems thinking it's cheap, right? 2 weeks later, you're going to open up the Wall Street Journal, and there's going to be a news story that says, Ryder Systems has just borrowed $3 billion to replace its entire fleet. There goes your cheap stock. That's what I mean by pricing. It's about asking the right questions and checking off the box. There's nothing wrong with pricing if you're careful about asking those follow-up questions. Okay? So with Ryder Systems, that is generally, if you look at trucking companies, that is often the factor in why some companies look cheap or expensive. But the more general lesson I would draw here is be careful about those questions you ask. I'm supposed to talk to the Financial Times about Aramco later today or tomorrow. And so many of you might be familiar. Aramco is the Saudi Arabian, it's a Saudi Arabian oil company. Basically, it has the rights to all of the oil reserves in Saudi Arabia. It's a privately owned company. And there's talk now of it going public. And every investment bank is salivating because if it does go public, this could be the largest IPO in history. The initial numbers that were thrown out there is Aramco is worth about $2 trillion. And actually, the basis is not that bad. It has about 8 times the reserves that ExxonMobil does. So if you're doing this on a pricing basis, ExxonMobil has a $300 billion market cap. 8 times 300 billion is 2.4 billion, 2.4 trillion. So 2 trillion did not sound unreasonable. But since then, the numbers keeps dropping every time you look at it. And there's a simple reason for that. ExxonMobil is a publicly traded oil company. It produces oil, it tries to make money, and when it makes money, it returns it to stockholders. 95% of the Saudi budget is covered by Aramco right now. Aramco is its biggest. So one of the ways the Saudi government is able to fund itself is 85% of Aramco's earnings goes to the Saudi government. It calls it dividends right now, but it's really, you know, it's like a tax slash, you can call it whatever you want. So the question that you would face if you're investing in Aramco is, let's say Aramco goes public and it issues shares. You're saying, well, then the Saudi government has sold off its stake, it can't get dividends anymore, but without that money, there will be no budget. You can't afford to run. So the question then becomes, what tax rate would the Saudi government have to impose on Aramco to make up for, this isn't a small piece, this is your entire budget. And that has become the difference. So if your tax rate is going to be 80% or 75% to make up for the lost revenues, the multiple of EBITDA you would pay for Aramco is going to be a lot, lot lower than the multiple of EBITDA you'd be willing to pay for ExxonMobil. So that's all I'm going to talk to him about, effective tax rate. He's going to want to talk about reserves and how. Those are all wonderful, but if 85% of your earnings are going to go towards to the government to cover its budget, that's going to lower the multiple of EBITDA you'd be willing to pay for the company. Okay. Let's do one final example, maybe second from final example. Grocery stores are incredibly boring businesses to look at, right? They're low margin, low growth, very non-discretionary. For a long time, if you looked at grocery stores, they all traded at low multiples of revenues, had tiny margins, but huge turnover ratio. Until Whole Foods came along, every grocery store looked like every other grocery store. They all sold at deeply discounted prices, margins of 0.5%, 1%, 1.5%. This was in 2007. Whole Foods comes along. An equity research analyst tracking grocery store didn't know what to do with Whole Foods. Why? Because it had a margin 4 times larger, 5 times larger than the rest of the sector. So when they saw Whole Foods with the higher margins, of course they got excited. The first time they'd seen excitement in their sector in I don't know how long. So in 2007, it's the first time I looked at Whole Foods. I took grocery stores in the U.S., I took their price-to-sales ratios, or I could have done enterprise value-to-sales. It would have been roughly the same thing. I put net profit margin on the other axis, and I did a scatter plot. Notice how scatter plots are often the starting point for almost every one of my pricing because it gives you a visual. You know, it lets you see what the relationship looks like. So I plotted all the grocery stores. So there are all the grocery stores between the two lines. And there's Whole Foods. I remember talking to an equity research analyst in 2007 saying, how come the pricing multiple for Whole Foods is so much higher than the rest of the sector? And he said, well, that's easy. It's got a higher margin. I said, that's true. But even if you control for higher margins, it still looks expensive. He says, no, you can't control for higher margins. And I didn't quite get that. He said, I can't. Because it's easy to control for higher margins. If you take the grocery sector and you take price to sales against net profit margins, you get a regression line. You put in the higher profit margin for Whole Foods into it, the predicted price to sales ratio would have got to be 0.43, which would have put them at the top of the list, but they were actually trading at 1.4 times revenues. Even after you control for the fact that they're much higher margins than everybody else, they looked expensive to me. But it was the star of the moment. 2009, I visit them again. This is 2 years later. Where's Whole Foods now? It's gone from above the line, way above the line, to becoming almost the cheapest stock in the retail sector. What happened? Its margins dropped. People started selling off the stock. All the excitement started to leave the stock. Now when I pushed in the numbers, I got a predicted price to sales of 0.36, but the actual price to sales had dropped to 0.31. Whole Foods had gone from being the most overvalued stock by far to almost the most undervalued stock in the entire sector. Then I looked at them in 2010. Where's Whole Foods now? Must be somewhere there. Right? Oh, sorry, where is it? Must be, I think it's slightly above the line. Oh, it's back to being overvalued again. Overvalued, undervalued, overvalued. This started like watching a manic depressive in action, right? Manic, depressed, manic. Then you get to 2015. I'm sorry, 2015. Whole Foods is now part of the group. Notice there's a new star in town. Stock called Sprouts. It's a California-based Whole Foods. You know, it's like Whole Foods, but it's, you know, the higher growth. Basically, my point is when you get a company that is very different from the rest of the sector, analysts don't know what to do with the company. They overshoot. Then they undershoot, then they overshoot, then they undershoot. Finally, they figure it out. It takes about 6 or 7 years before the stock settles in. Almost every sector, when you talk about a disruptor, that disruptor often looks very different from the rest of the sector, right? The automobile sector. Who's the outlier now? Tesla. Auto analysts have no idea what to do with Tesla. And it'll take them about 5 years to figure it out. Eventually, Tesla will find its place in the automobile sector. But until that happens, you're going to see them overshoot, undershoot. And how is it going to manifest itself? Small pieces of information about Tesla are going to translate into big jumps in either direction of the price. Louis, last session, we were talking about Tesla, the most recent announcement, where they said they'd deliver 25,000 cars on time, which for Tesla is completely new. They never deliver anything on time. And of course, the stock went up $40. But that is the nature of companies that are different from the sector. It takes a while for analysts to actually get their hands around the company and say, okay, now it makes sense. So if you're going to follow something interesting in the grocery sector, Whole Foods is no longer it. It's become a boring grocery company. People have figured it out. You know what I would follow? I'd follow Sprouts. Because Sprouts is a company that's clearly very different from the rest of the sector. Follow it for a few years and see how the market... You don't have to buy it or sell it. Don't do anything crazy. But at least track it to see how the market adjusts to something that's very different. Remember the Amazon valuation I did in January 2000 that I used as my young company valuation? I don't know whether you remember the value that I got. I did an intrinsic valuation. I came up with a value of $34. The stock was trading at $84. I concluded the stock was significantly overvalued. But then I decided to price Amazon instead of valuing it. So this is where we're going to leave the valuation domain. Valuation domain, what did I do? I built up revenues and margins and cash flows for Amazon and came up with the value for Amazon. Now I'm going to try to price Amazon. To price Amazon, what do I need to do? I need to find out what the market is pricing, other companies like it, and then use it to price Amazon. So in January 2000, exactly the same point in time where I found Amazon to be massively overvalued, I took every dot-com stock and I plotted it. This is my scatter plot of price to sales against net margin. And even the scatter plot tells you the story about the sector. First, look at the x-axis in the sector. What is it denominated from? Minus 100% to 0%. In this sector, there wasn't a single stock in the sector that was making money. They were all losing money. Okay, it's young companies. Then I plotted it. And what's your first reaction when you see that plot? There's no trend there, no pattern. It looks like a shotgun blast, right? Undaunted, I decided to run a regression anyway. I knew I was going to find a crappy output, but I said, no, what's the harm in trying? So I ran a regression of price to sales against net profit margin, and I'll give you the news you should expect. The R squared was close to zero. And here's a scary output. As my net margining gets more negative, what happens to my price to sales ratio? It actually gets higher. So if you were writing a book on irrational exuberance, this could be exhibit one. Look how crazy people are. The more money you lose, the higher your price to sales ratio becomes. But that would be a little unfair because nobody was buying a dot-com stock based on how much money they made last year, right? So why were you buying? Put yourself back. Or you can put yourself in whatever current sector you're in, which has high growth. Why do you buy these young growth companies? What are you basing your pricing on? What do you hope that they will do? You hope they will survive. You hope they will grow. And you hope they will make money. All hopes. But that's the nature of pricing young companies. So I'm going to take you through two ways in which I tried to price you, that you can try to price young growth companies. And I'm going to apply the first to Amazon. I'm going to start off with three hypotheses about pricing in this sector. And you tell me whether you agree with them. If you look at the price to sales ratios in that sector, first I would assume that as your revenues stay to get higher, your price to sales ratio will get lower. It's much more difficult to trade at 100 times revenues when you have $1 billion in revenues than in a million. So as revenues go up, I'd expect the price to sales ratio to come down. Second, this is all about growth, right? But the only growth I can focus on is revenue growth. The rest is all losses. So I would expect the higher the revenue growth at your company, the higher the price to sales ratio. The higher the revenues, the lower the price to sales. The higher the revenue growth, the higher the price to sales. And here's the third hypothesis I would have. Most young companies don't make it. We know that. So I would assume that companies that are more likely to survive will trade at higher price to sales ratios than companies that are less likely to survive. And here I ran into a bit of a roadblock. How do you measure the likelihood of survival? And with dot-com companies and young companies in general, the way you fail is you run out of cash. It's not because you have debt, not because of distress. You just run out of cash. So to measure the likelihood of survival, I looked at how much cash each company had and hypothesized that the more cash a company had, the greater the chance of survival. So I put in the level of revenues, revenue growth, and how much cash they had, and I ran the regression. The R squared I got was 32%. You're saying, that's pretty low. In a sector like this, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. This is about as good as it's going to get. 32% might be awful in the steel sector, but in this sector, if I can explain 32% of what's going on, I'm going to take it and run with it. And then I plugged in Amazon's actual numbers into this regression. Remember, this is at the exact same time I found Amazon to be overvalued in my DCF. I plugged the numbers for Amazon into this regression. I got a predicted price to sales ratio of 30.42. It was actually trading at 25.6 times revenues. So based on its pricing, what am I finding? That Amazon is underpriced. It's cheap. You're saying, how can a stock be both cheap and expensive at the same time? Because I'm asking two different questions. In my intrinsic valuation, what's the question I'm asking? Given the cash flows, growth, and business potential for Amazon, is Amazon a good investment? The answer is no. What's the question I'm asking here? Given how the market is pricing other dot-com stocks, is Amazon cheap or expensive? And I'm discovering that given how the market is pricing other dot-com stocks, Amazon is actually cheap. And both statements would actually have been right a year later. A year later, Amazon had lost 80% of its value. So there's my intrinsic valuation vindicated. But it lost only 80%. You're saying, what do you mean only 80%? You know what the rest of the dot-com sector lost? 95%. When you make a pricing statement, you're making a relative statement. Given these other things I'm comparing to, this looks cheap. But if they're all overpriced and they collapse, the way this will manifest itself, your stock will collapse by less than the rest of the sector. That's the Achilles heel of pricing, is you are making a relative judgment. Here's the other way. Yeah, go ahead, Rachel. Well, you got your DCF done, right? So in a sense, the DCF told you on an intrinsic value basis whether the stock was cheap or expensive. Now start with a blank page, right? Now you're going to say, you're doing delta. So you do delta against the other airlines. Is delta cheap or expensive? Different question than what you asked in your DCF. Because then you're going to be comparing to United and Southwest and the rest of the... And you have to decide whether you're going to compare just to domestic airlines or to global airlines. Because the conclusion you might draw might actually vary depending on which sector you pick. And the question you're asking, given how the market is pricing these other airlines, is Delta cheap or expensive? And you have the freedom to decide what the pricing metric should be. Maybe it'll be the price per passenger flown, price per run. So it's a different question, and be willing to hear a different answer. The only problem is, what's the final part of this project? I know it's way down, way back in the past. I asked you, well, after you've done your DCF valuation and your pricing, what do you have to tell me as your final? You have to tell me whether you'll buy the stock or sell the stock. And already you can see, well, what should I base it on? That's where I'm going to put you on the spot and say, which one do you want to hang your hat on? But that's the way to think about pricing. It's a very different question, and the answer can be very different from your DCF. Yes?
What are the, limitations of a launch strategy based on pricing?
Think about that regression, right? So when I did that regression, did everybody get the question? A long short strategy is basically buy the cheapest stocks, you sell the most expensive. So let's take our regression and say we're going to create a hedge fund based on it. So you buy the five cheapest and you sell short of the five most expensive. What has to happen for you to make money? They have to move towards your regression line. If they both move towards your regression line, you get a double whammy. You don't even have to be right about the market, right? Because as long as you're right about which direction they move, you've taken the market out of the equation.
Right. So yeah. Exactly.
That is assuming you've done neutralized it well. So in the dot-com sector, if I bought the five cheapest, of which Amazon would be one, and sold the five most expensive in January 2000, a year later, even though the entire sector had dropped by 90%, I'd have actually made money, because the stocks that I bought would have dropped by only 80%. The stocks that I sold short would have dropped by 95%. It's a little easier said than done, because it requires constant readjustment of your strategy as you go through the year, because as the stocks change, you have to keep recalibrating your strategy to make. But that's the basis for hedge funds. That's how hedge funds were first created, is to take advantage of market mistakes without taking a point of view on the market.
Yeah. Okay, and you can diversify away the firm-specific risks, right?
Well, if you have enough stocks on each side, basically, right? So as long as you don't have a set... So if you buy the five cheapest, and they happen to be all oil companies, and your five most expensive are all tech companies, you really haven't diversified away. So if you want diversification, you got to make sure that when you buy and sell, that you're creating a broad enough group of stocks on both sides that you don't end up with a sector focus.
Right. Yeah.
And that you can do, because all you have to do is add criteria and say, I'll buy the cheapest and the most expensive within each sector. So many hedge funds will create a sector constraint where you don't end up with more than 20% to 30% in any given sector. That's not the reason I said that they had a problem, because unlimited downside, unlimited upside was not the problem. What was the reason for not shorting stocks? Is I didn't control my time horizon. It's not the unlimited that bothers me. It's the time horizon part, right? Because, I could lose all my money when I buy stocks. So it's not the unlimited part that is a problem. It's the fact that I don't control my time horizon. When I sell short, I'm borrowing somebody else's shares, and when he wants it back, he wants it back. I can't tell him, look, I have a long time horizon, I'm not returning it to you now. So my problem with selling short has never been the unlimited, it's been the time horizon part. Okay. Any other questions? So let me do one other thing about one other way in which you can deal with the fact, especially if you have a young company. You're valuing a Tesla, you're valuing Yelp, you're valuing one of these young companies. And you can deal with the fact that looking at the numbers today gives you strange-looking output. Let's face it, in all these companies, you're valuing them based on what you think they will be rather than what they are right now. Right, that's a common theme. And across all young growth companies, you're valuing on a vision of what they will be rather than what they are today. So here's the other way you can deal with the fact that they're young companies. Rather than take a multiple of earnings right now or revenues right now or book value right now, you can take a multiple of revenues in 5 years. Revenue, it's called a forward multiple. What does it allow you to do? It allows you to bring more substance to your company. So if you look at Tesla right now, it looks hopelessly overpriced relative to the rest of the automobile sector because it has tiny revenues, it has losses. So if I try to do anything and compare to the rest of the automobile sector, it's going to look overpriced. But if you look at the revenues 10 years from now, and Luis, what were your revenues for Tesla 10 years from now, like 80 billion or so? Yeah, if I take the 80 billion revenues 10 years from now, I divide the market cap today by 80 billion in revenues, and I do the same thing for Ford, it doesn't look that outlandish anymore. So the reason I bring up Ford is, yes, last week, Tesla's market cap exceeded that of Ford. Even though it sells, 60,000 cars, and Ford sells millions of cars, and people look and say, that doesn't make sense. And if you base it on today's numbers, of course it doesn't make sense. But if I start using numbers from 10 years out, and I forecast out $80 billion in revenues and $10 billion in operating income, then maybe Tesla is actually cheap relative to Ford on a forward multiple basis. So when you talk about forward multiples, that's what you're doing, is you're dividing the market value today by some expected revenues. And guess what? Your DCF, you already have those expected numbers. You don't have to make them up. You're looking at that multiple. The one thing I would be careful about is when you apply this forward multiple to Tesla and you come up with a number 10 years out, that number is the value for Tesla 10 years out. To bring it back to today, you got to jump through all kinds of hoops. In fact, when I did my first valuation of Tesla, I came up with a value of about $68 billion 10 years from now. This was way back in time, like 3 years ago. $68 billion was my expected terminal value. The value that I had for the stock was actually $8.15 billion. People said, how did he get from $68 billion to $8.15? So I drew this graph of how I lost value, how I went from that big terminal value to value today. First, I discounted back at the risk-free rate for 10 years. This is a pure time value effect. My $68 billion becomes $52 billion. Second, I adjusted for the fact that they're risky companies. When I discounted the cost of capital, the $52 billion becomes $27 billion. Then I allowed for the fact that they have negative cash flows in the first 5 years. To get to Nirvana, that big terminal value at the end, I've got to have those big, big negative cash flows. You take the negative cash flow effect, the $27.8 billion becomes $12.8 billion. So I've gone from $68.3 billion to $12.8 billion. Then I adjust for the fact that there's a 10% chance I will not make it, and for the debt and the cash, and by the time I'm done cleaning up, the value that I get today, and that's what we do in DCF. And that's why your DCF value is so much lower than your terminal value. Compare your own DCF. You see that by comparing the end value to the value today, is because we have all these cuts we need to take out of the value. And that's why when I see equity research analysts use forward multiples, I'm always checking to see whether they're being careful about the fact that this number is way out there. You still have to tell me what I should be paying today. One final point about pricing. Right? When you look at the data, you will be tempted to impose your will on the data. What I mean by that is you can look at the equation that, well, high-risk companies should have low P.E. ratios. High-growth companies should have high P.E. ratios. But let's face it, the data is the data. You can't fight it. If the data gives you a different message, you've got to listen to that message. And I'll give you my simplest example of letting the data tell you how to price stocks. In October of 2013, when Twitter went public, I did a discounted cash flow valuation of Twitter just a month before it went public based on its prospectus. And I valued Twitter at about $18 per share or about $11 billion in value based on a vision of the future, which I thought was pretty optimistic. The stock, of course, went public at 26, opened up at 45, went as high as 76. The pricing game went out of control. So at the time that I did my DCF, I also said I'd like to do a pricing of Twitter. So what do I have to do to price Twitter? I have to look at other companies like Twitter and look at what investors are paying for those companies. So I pulled up a bunch of social media companies. I got their market caps because I could observe that. I pulled up every number I could on the company, revenues, EBITDA, EBIT, number of users. And then I put my statistics to use. And let me explain what I mean by that. I wanted to see why investors were pricing some companies at much higher values and others at lower values. And rather than impose my will and say it should be about future cash flows and future revenues, I looked at the statistics to see what variables best explain differences in market cap across companies. So you have revenues, EBITDA, net income. I don't know whether I have the statistics. I did a correlation. You know what a correlation matrix is? I basically looked to see which variables are correlated to market cap. So look at the first column. Ignore the enterprise value. Market cap and enterprise value are almost perfectly correlated because these companies have very little debt, so market cap is enterprise value. Go down. Revenue is pretty highly correlated, right? 89%. EBITDA by 97%. Net income 90%. And then you get to number of users. The strongest variable explaining why some companies had high market cap and others had low market cap was the number of users that that company had. You're saying, how are you going to use that? Well, go back and look at this. If you look across the companies, on average, markets seem to be paying about $130 per user. But if I looked at the median value, it looks like the market is paying about $100 per user. $100 in market cap for every user. Let's do some pricing. Twitter at the time of its IPO, 240 million users. If your job is pricing Twitter based on that previous table, what pricing would you attach to Twitter? Market's paying about $100 per user. They have 240 million users. 240 million times 100 is 24 billion. That is actually very close to the opening price of $45 per share. If your job is pricing, just price the damn company. And pricing doesn't require sophisticated cash flows and discounted cash flow valuations and cost of capital. It's just looking to see what other people are paying for similar assets and attaching a number to your asset. So if you want to look at Snap on a pricing basis rather than a discounted cash flow basis, this is what you'd have to do. Look at the market caps of social media companies. And now actually the metric that investors seem to be using is not number of users. It's number of user minutes. I think we've moved up the sophistication layer because they said, well, look at Twitter's users. You have a lot of users. Nobody stays on. And one of the arguments for Snap being as highly priced as it was, it not only has 170 million users, but a typical Snap user spends 25 to 30 minutes every day on Snap, whereas a typical Twitter user spends only 2 minutes, and Facebook is like 55 minutes. So you can start thinking about all these elaborate metrics in pricing, and it's okay as long as you remember that at the end of the process, those users and user minutes have to become revenues and cash flows, and you're hoping that that will happen. So the pricing game in many ways is a much simpler, more direct game than the valuation game. Okay? I mean, we're trying to sell our house in New Jersey right now, and I'm doing intrinsic valuations every day in my basement of what my house is worth. Not. All I'm checking is what houses have sold in the town in the last couple of weeks. And I'm doing all kinds of extra. I've built a regression model, but there are not enough observations. The price of the house against square footage, number of bedrooms, number of bathrooms. And if I found that the number of chimneys is what's driving the pricing of houses in Chatham, it's in my regression. It's the more chimneys, the bigger the... You know what I'm going to do tomorrow? There are going to be chimneys coming out of my house from every part of the house. Who cares if there's a fireplace or not? Okay? That's what pricing is about. If you've isolated what the market is paying for, guess what? You're going to try to deliver it. And what if social media companies learned out of the fact that markets are paying for users? What do they focus on? Delivering more users, still more users. Because that's what the market seemed to be paying for. Now, so far, when we've talked about pricing, I've talked about lots of different sectors. We've talked about the grocery sector, the dot-com sector, social media stocks. But in every example, I compared my company to the entire sector or to a sector. Why can't I compare my... But the problem with staying sector-focused is The sample size is going to be smaller because some sectors might have only 10, 15, 20 companies. And if you add a country constraint on top, I want to look at only Brazilian retailers, your sector might have only 6 stocks. You're saying, what's wrong with that? In statistics, small samples are a problem, right? So what if I could just expand my sample to cover the entire market? Can I do that? Can I compare my company to how the rest of the market is priced? I mean, there are 7,300 U.S. stocks. Why can't I run a regression with all 7,300? Your first reaction is, that's too many, you can't control for differences. Why can't I? I've run regressions, after all, control for differences in growth, risk, and payout. So at the start of every year, here's what I do. I take my relative valuation, my pricing, and I expand it to the entire market. You can already see that this is almost a third-level question, right? Because the first question I asked was, on an intrinsic value basis, is my stock cheap? The second-level question I asked was, given how the sector is priced, is my market cheap? The third question I'm now asking is, given how the rest of the market is priced, is my stock cheap? So here's what I do. I took every stock that's publicly traded in the U.S. I took the price-earnings ratio of every stock. I took the expected growth rate of every stock, and I put a scatter plot. What does that look like? It just looks like, maybe if I hung it up in the Museum of Modern Art, it would go that's actually a good idea. Maybe I should start doing that. But it looks like nothing, right? It looks like a bunch of points the reason I picked growth is, what is the conventional wisdom? Higher growth companies have higher PE ratios. I wanted to see whether across the market that was true, at least based on the scatter plot. I'm not sure it's true. But I decided to take the entire market and try to run a regression for PE ratios. Remind me again what 3 variables drive PE ratios? Growth rate, risk, which you've captured in a beta or something, and payout ratio / return on equity, right? So here's what I did. I took the entire market and I ran a regression of price-earnings ratios against beta, capturing the risk factor, growth rate capturing the expected growth rate and a payout ratio. Again, remember I say focus on the 3 variables because that's what the original intrinsic valuation said should matter. Take a look at the top. What does it say for the R-squared? 42.7%. That's actually not bad. Looking across the entire market, I'm able to explain 43% of the variation in PE ratios using these 3 variables. Here's the output from the regression. Let's read the output. What does the constant tell me? It's basically the base from which I'm going to build off my predictions. The 3.527 in the beta tells me higher beta stocks have higher PE ratios or lower PE ratios? Higher PE ratios. But when we did the intrinsic valuation, higher risk went with lower PE ratios, right? And this is what I meant about not fighting the data. My first reaction when I saw that beta is, hey, the market must be wrong. Beta is supposed to have a negative coefficient. Don't do stupid things like erase the plus and put a minus saying that looks much better now. The data is what it is. And in this case, we'll see why this happens because it happens all the time. But it looks like at least across the market, higher beta stocks tend to have higher PE ratios. What's a coefficient on growth telling you? As growth increases, PE increases. And finally, on the payout ratio, as payout ratio increases, PE ratio increases. What do I check to see if the regression is statistically significant? I check the R-squared, but what else do I need to check to make sure it's working? I check the T-statistics. And what am I checking for? I'm checking to make sure that none of these T-statistics are like 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, which would mean it's pure noise and I should take them out. So if on one of these variables I'd seen a T-statistic of 0.3, I'd have just taken it out of the regression and rerun the regression without it because otherwise you're just adding noise to your prediction. I don't know how much you remember about your multiple regressions, but I've probably broken about a dozen statistical rules in running this regression. And here's what. When you run a multiple regression, let's see how much you remember about multiple regression. What's supposed to be true about the relationship between your dependent variables? I'm sorry, your independent variables. You have 3 independent variables. What should be true about the relationship across the independent variables? They're supposed to be uncorrelated with each other. I still remember my first statistics class, or actually my third or eighth, I lost count of them after a while. In this multiple regression, when we got to the multiple regressions, the statistics professor kept using this word multicollinearity. I thought he was talking a different language. I said, what the hell are you talking about? Now I think I get it. Multicollinearity is when independent variables are correlated with each other. You're saying, so what? What are my three independent variables? Growth, beta, and payout. Do you think they're independent of each other? What tends to be true? When I look at high growth companies and I look at the beta, what should I generally find? High betas or low betas for high growth companies? I'd probably find high betas. And in terms of payout ratio, low payout ratio, right? High growth companies. And in fact, when I ran the correlation across, I'll come back to this, when I ran the correlation across my independent variables, that's exactly what I found. I didn't find zero correlations across, so my independent variables are correlated with each other. And here's why it matters. Remember I found that high beta stocks have high PE ratios and that made no sense? Now do you see why high beta stocks might show high PE ratios in my regression? What do high beta stocks also have? They also have high growth, and after a while, the computer doesn't know you're talking about betas or growth. It just sees three columns. And if all your high beta stocks have high growth, after a while, the computer gets really confused about whether the variable you're feeding it measures growth or whether it measures risk. So when you have multicollinearity, you are going to get coefficients that have the wrong sign. So be ready for this. When you take your 200 companies and you start running regressions, you might find that on some variables, the coefficients you get have the wrong sign based on what you'd expect. Don't fight it. That's the way it is. Just let it go. Your forecast will still work, but you have a multicollinearity problem. Here's the second. The regression that I ran is a linear regression, right? As opposed to what? Well, a relationship between variables. You can have a positive relationship between two variables, but the relationship might be non-linear. I've assumed linearity. That could get me into trouble. And finally, the coefficient on this regression is negative. If you look at the regression coefficient, it's negative, minus 3.95. You're saying, so what? When I plug numbers into this regression, I can end up with a negative predicted value. It's entirely possible. But the problem is, if this is PE ratio I'm predicting, a negative predicted value is kind of a strange number. How can a company have a negative PE? So three things worry me about this regression. One is that I'm assuming linearity when it might not be the case. The second is that there's correlation across the independent variables. The third is that my negative intercept can make my predicted values go crazy. There is something I can do about the negative intercept. If any of you used a statistics package like Minitab or SPSS or SAS, when you run a regression, there's actually an option that allows you to set the intercept to zero. It's usually not a good idea to do it because it forces your regression through the origin of it. But if you do that, here's what you get for the PE ratio. This is same regression with the intercept set to zero. I get a regression of PE ratio against beta, growth, and payout, and beta now becomes statistically insignificant when I force it through the regression. So if I were running this regression to make predicted values, I would actually take beta out of the regression. Why leave it in there once the t-statistic has become... But this is a trick you can do when you have negative intercepts and they're giving you trouble. If they're not giving you trouble, you can leave them alone. But sometimes when they give you trouble, just force the regression through the intercept or through the origin. It'll kind of get rid of your problem. Now, why am I doing all of this? Because I want to price a stock, right? So let's say I have this regression in front of me and I want to price a company. Let's give the company a name. Let's suppose that I want to price Disney, and I have the regression in front of me. So basically, I've brought the regression of the coefficients from the regression. And I tell you that Disney has a growth rate of 15%, a beta 1.25, and a dividend payout ratio of 20%, all of which I should be able to pull off Yahoo Finance or any other data source. So I have the numbers for my company. I have the regression for the entire U.S. market. I plug Disney's numbers into the regression. So I put in a 15% growth rate, a beta 1.25, and a 20% payout ratio into the regression. I get a predicted PE for Disney of 30.24. Explain to me in very intuitive terms what the 30.24 is telling me. If you were to describe this 30.24 to somebody, how would you describe the 30.24? You want to try?
Given what the market thinks and how it prices stocks, Disney should trade it.
Exactly. Given how the market is pricing other stocks, and given Disney's numbers on the fundamentals, this is the multiple at which Disney should be trading for, 30.24. It's actually trading at 25 times earnings. So complete the process. If I believe the 30.24, that makes Disney a cheap or an expensive stock? It's cheap. In fact, it's undervalued by underpriced. Let's take the value word valued out of it. Underpriced by about 20%. And if I follow through and create a hedge fund, then Disney will be one of my buys. I can be a one-person hedge fund. Because this regression equation I can then apply to every one of my 7,000 stocks. And at the end of the process, I can say, these are my 100 cheapest, these are my 100 most expensive. I'll buy the 100 cheapest, I'll sell short on the 100 most expensive, and then pray and hope that they all move to the regression line. If you're of quant funds, this is basically what quant funds do. I've done a very simplistic regression, but can you imagine hiring 10 PhDs in statistics and mathematics and they work through the data? They could probably create some incredibly powerful statistical tools for predicting pricing, but don't let them ever tell you that they're valuing companies. They're not. They're playing the pricing game. They're just using big data and sophisticated statistics to carry to the next level. I'm not going to drag you there because that's all statistics. There's nothing finance, nothing valuation beyond this point. It's about building better statistical ways of coming up with cheap and expensive. Any questions on... So, yeah, go ahead. My go-to is whatever's free for me. For right now, it's Capital IQ, but let's face it, FactSet has the same data, Roy. You know how they all get the data? They scrape computer databases now because this data actually gets filed with the SEC. So it's in a big computer database as data. And all of these data services go, you know, they troll through those databases. They pull the same raw data. So it's not like there's some guy at Capital IQ who's looking up 10Ks, making judgment calls and say, I'll move this year. It's all coming from the same raw computer data. So if you have access to any of the big databases, and the two most comprehensive are Capital IQ. The advantage of Capital IQ and FactSet is they have this friendly interface where pulling the data into your Excel spreadsheet is easy to do. But you pay through the nose for that. So if you cannot access Capital IQ because you're working in a job or you don't have Capital IQ, there are other databases that you can access, especially in the U.S., that you could probably get for a couple of $100, $300, $500. And it's well worth having the raw data at your fingertips rather than have somebody feed it to you in the form of multiples or metrics, which is what Yahoo Finance does for you, right? You look up a number, it gives you all these multiples, but you're at their mercy as to how they computed these multiples. Yeah. Any other questions? Now, if you look at that coefficient on growth, and if you go back to the regression, see the coefficient on growth, 174? Roughly speaking, what does that tell you? That's how much the market is paying for growth, right? And I've kept track of that coefficient because I've been running this regression a long time, since 2000. I actually have it before 2000. So this is the coefficient on growth in the regressions I've been running each year. So this is how much the market is willing to pay for growth. Now, I'm going to add a second column. If you remember, I did that implied equity risk premium for the U.S. market. That is the market price for taking risk. So basically, I now have a price for growth and a price for risk, at least a market price. So let's say you're a high-growth, high-risk company. And it's early 2000. You're in nirvana. Do you see why you're in nirvana? The market price for the market's willing to pay 2.1 times earnings for every 1% of growth, and it's charging you almost nothing for risk. So risk is costing you very little in the market, and growth is being rewarded a lot. So if in early 2000 you looked at a high-growth, high-risk company, it was trading at 150 times earnings. Let's say nothing changes about your company. Your growth stays the same, your risk stays the same. It's 2 years later. Tell me what's changed. One, the market is now halved what it's willing to pay for growth, right? It's gone from 2.105 to 1.003, and it's doubled almost what it's charging for risk. So you could be the same high-growth, high-risk company, and all of a sudden, even though nothing's changed about your company, you're trading at 40 times earnings, and you're saying, what the heck happened? Yeah, I used to trade at 150 times earnings. These two numbers are numbers I track every year because it tells me what a high-growth, high-risk company will be treated by the market at that point in time is. In fact, I was quite surprised to see the jump in the price the market is willing to pay for growth at the start of this year. Because that was a pretty hefty jump from 2016 to go from 0.75 to 1.71. Holding all else constant, what that would lead me to believe is today if you're a high growth company, you're getting a much higher PE ratio relative to other stocks than you did a year ago. Because the market seems to be much more comfortable paying a high price for growth. Talked about PEG ratios, right? PEG ratios, PE divided by growth. And I said PEG ratios are affected by growth as well. So I took the PEG ratio and I plotted against growth, just as I did for PE. I know this might be just game playing where I'm looking at graphs and making up stuff. But to me, it looked like there was a, if you look at it, there's almost a curve. If you see it, this does not look linear to me. Why does it matter? Because if I run a regression with a linear relationship, where the relationship is not linear, I'm going to end up coming up with the wrong conclusions. I'm going to do a trick that generally has worked for me. I mean, if your statistics professor would probably blanch at what I'm going to say next, but I'm going to say it anyway. Whenever a problem like this, one of the ways the problem seems to disappear, at least in finance, is you take the natural log. You know how the natural log is? The little ln, you know, the two ln. You've never used those buttons in your calculator. What the hell do they even put these buttons for? What a waste of buttons. There's this ln button and an log 10 button. Ignore the log 10, but you might as well rip it out. It never gets used in finance. Just throw it away. But the ln button is a natural log. What it does is it actually makes numbers which are very diverse into much closer numbers. It brings them together. So here's what I did. I took the natural log of the growth rate. So basically, it's the same company. So in my Excel spreadsheet, I added a second column and said, here's the growth rate. Take the natural log of the growth rate. And I did a scatter plot of PEG against it. This might, again, be hopeful thinking on my part. But if I compare those two graphs, this one looks a little more linear to me. You say, how do you know? In fact, if you want to test in your statistics package, you can check. There's a test for linearity. You can check to see if the relationship. You don't have to take my word. So when you do this on data, you can always test, if you have a decent statistics package, on whether the relationship has become linear. When I ran my regression of PEG ratios, here's how it manifests itself. I had beta, payout ratio, and notice the difference? I have the log of the expected growth rate. Okay. The regression has an R squared of about 19.7. I'm not 19.7%. I'm not happy about that, but it's again not my. If I were allowed to pick a weapon, I would pick DCFs. You wanted to do pricing, I followed you into this forest. I'm just holding a mirror up and saying, this is a horrible multiple. Why are you guys even doing this? Why don't you come back to the DCF side? You insist on staying on the pricing side. The R squared just reflects that reality. So again, if you run into a problem with the data, draw on very basic statistics to kind of get over that those stuff. So I'm going to close off by showing you a bunch. There's nothing much to read in these pages, because what I do at the start of every year is I run these regressions for U.S. companies, Japanese companies, European companies. So basically, it's a regression I talked about. And the reason I run these regressions is to show you how much market share in common, and as well as differences across markets. So this is a PE regression, growth, payout, beta. Growth, payout, beta. Notice Australia, New Zealand, Canada. Beta is not in the regression because I tried it. The coefficient was statistically not significant, so I took it out of the regression. And I do this not just for PE ratios. I do this for price to book. Notice growth, beta, payout, and return on equity. Why? Because return on equity is a companion variable. You do price to, so EV to EBITDA, basically. Again, with each one, I use what I learned from the DCF to decide what to control for. With subtle differences, when I'm looking at equity multiples and I think about growth and equity earnings per share. When I'm looking at enterprise value multiples and I think about growth, if I can, I'd like to get a growth in revenue or operating income rather than earnings per share. But I'll take whatever I can get. It's what works that drives pricing. It's not what you and I might think is critical that should drive pricing. So as you go through the mystery project, look through these pages, not so much because you want to replicate my regressions, but look through these pages because what we've been doing for the last two sessions is really all pricing all the time. This has nothing to do with DCFs. It's got very little to do with what you think about cash flows and growth and risk. It's got everything to do with what the market is willing to pay for something. So those are regressions. So I'll close with this page. When in relative valuation, remember what you're doing. You're not valuing the company. You're putting a value in the company given how other companies that you're comparing it to are being priced. Second, there are no absolutely similar companies. You have to think about controlling for differences when you do the comparison. So relative valuation is all pricing all the time. And that's what the mystery project is about, is testing whether you can price companies.
So I have a question. When you did the bottom up data, we took out, we looked at the entire sector and kind of the smallest sector ever. Mm-hmm.
What do you mean, significance level of the beta?
Like, the beta that we predict for our stock, if we use the entire sector data, is the prediction that we get so significant?
As long as it's independently estimated, the standard error of the beta will be whatever the standard error of an individual regression beta is divided by the square root of the number of companies in the sample.
Yeah.
So it'll be much smaller. So when you say significance, it'll be a much tighter range. So your actual beta will be in a range of 0.03 or 0.02.
And then another question for the mystery project, or just in general, if you want to go for Monte Carlo,
you can't get away from multiple linearity. Is impossible to get away from. And here's why. If you look at any kind of financial fundamentals, they're going to be correlated with each other, almost by definition.
Yeah.
Growth and reinvestment, how can they not be correlated with each other? Okay, so growth, reinvestment, interest. So you basically say that's going to be a given no matter how I frame the regression. It's not going to go away. All it means is you can't read the individual coefficients too carefully. You can still use the overall regression. You can still make forecasts. But don't get too excited about a coefficient having the wrong sign. Because that's all that the multiple linearity.
Yeah, but if we would use a nonlinear regression on it or something.
That's fine. You can do that. Just be careful because nonlinear regressions become less intuitive, right? So when I do a linear regression and say growth increases, what will my PE increase? When you throw nonlinear regression, the relationship becomes much more statistical. You're almost more at the mercy of the statistics.
It could be,
but you could also take nonlinear variables and make them linear and stay with a linear regression, which is what I did with the PEG ratio. I could have run a nonlinear regression. Rather than do that, I used the log of the growth rate to make it linear and ran a linear regression because I'm still more comfortable with a linear relationship and a linear regression than I am with a nonlinear.
Yeah, that makes sense. Thank you.
Good.
Question. I actually printed out last year's notes.
Yeah.
And I saw the huge difference between the R squared
between the two. You heard it, right? Because the average is
running. How does it vary so much though?
Like,
it was
market variation. So, right? It's not even the same sample. The only thing that's the same is the company names are the same. The price to book, the return on equities all get recomputed based on the new numbers. There's no overlap of the data at all. Right? And because there's no overlap, the R squared continues. Mm-hmm. Hi.
What you mentioned at the beginning of the lesson, if your data set you end up with five Chinese companies that are undervalued or something like that, how, in terms of the project, how should we think about something? Should we just say there's a fundamental problem here?
Why would five Chinese companies come out looking undervalued? Either the Chinese market is overpriced or Chinese stocks are risky, right?
So you
either create a risk variable that captures geography, maybe a country risk premium, or if you believe it's a Chinese market-driven overpricing, you figure out a way to bring in that pricing. So throwing in a China dummy variable into your regression will capture both of those, right? You can call it China or not China. And if all Chinese stocks trade at a pricing multiple 50% above everybody else, that variable is not going to count.
So rather than just saying we're going to look at all the companies that don't fall into that problem, we should try to adapt our regression.
Because you don't want to throw those five out. One of those five might still be cheap. Because if you just say, look, I'm getting all Chinese stocks, it must be wrong, I'm going to take all Chinese stocks out of the regression. That's not right either, because some of those stocks might in fact be cheap. So you want to take the China effect out. After I take the China effect out, is Alibaba still cheap? The answer is yes, you might still buy.
In your working with these regressions, have you noticed any mean reversion in the way these kind of
have a very long time.
Aramco has 90,000 records, not the token.
Oh, okay. So when I go to the cache assumption that you made the cache why not finance with debt?
Who's going to lend money to a startup?
I mean, if it's someone like Tesla, does he grow potential in the future? It could be angel investors too.
No, they will never lend money. They might invest equity, but Tesla is not a young startup.
Okay. I mean, but is it okay to assume that it could
not have an assumption. That's the reality. That's how startups shut down. When you run out of cash, when you're unable to raise fresh debt. Because it's not like they borrow money and default on the debt. They run out of cash. They can't pay their salaries, so they shut the offices down and they have to go home.
And this line, the first one, the constant. Yeah. What does that actually stand for?
That's the intercept in the regression.
Oh, okay.
That's all.
One last thing. Yeah. What's the success rate in investing based on intrinsic valuation price?
The quality of intrinsic valuation varies so widely among people who fail to do it. I wouldn't even know.
You can't
observe. Okay. Like, how do you observe what people use to base their decisions?
But just based on your experience, like.
Even my friends, I can't see what people do. I can see what they buy and what they sell. I have no idea what's going on. They can tell me they do VCRs.
Yeah.
I don't know.
For example, if you were doing investments based on your intrinsic valuation, what's the success rate of it actually meeting your expectations?
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Portfolio basis has done reasonably well for